either side, all sides are in very thick echo chambers. We only want to hear what we want to hear.
Yeah.
We do not want to hear the other side. And what you said earlier, shouldn't art ask questions? Shouldn't we all be talking? The simple answer is yes. I think everybody is shouting, especially on social media. again, on both sides, on every side, everybody is shouting. Nobody is listening.
Yeah.
Whether it's talking about a certain kind of injustice, whether it's talking about war, whether it's talking about poverty, everyone is shouting. I wish for a moment somebody would sit and listen. And if theater or music creates that space where I can be quiet and listen to the other.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. I'm Sandeep, and probably say my name every time on every episode pisses the hell out of you. But hey, you know what? It's better than saying like, share. See, clearly, I can't promote my own podcast. Like, share, subscribe, guys. Click on the link below never to miss an update or an episode. But, you know, in the pretext of saying that, I already said it. So fucking how brilliant is that? Hey, you know, the thing is spreading the word to people who trust you to share stuff that they think that you think that they will like. Why did I make an unnecessary statement which could be simple, so complicated? Basically, if you pass on stuff to them saying, hey, this is a good listen, they might take it with more sincerity and they might more listen to it. What the fuck are you doing today, Sandeep? Anyway, what I meant is if you pass on something to them and you say, hey, give this a listen, they're more likely to listen to it than an algorithm or some marketing thing which is being pushed out there on social media. So do share the videos, do share the links to the audio, which is the podcast in itself. But of course, us Indians are like, no, it has video. But then I thought it's laughing stock, but clearly Spotify wants video. And so does every other podcast platform. So maybe I'm the fool who's not catching on. Anyhow, this is available across platforms, I think everywhere from Substack, if you're on Substack. It's also available at, I should know this, what do you call it? On Apple, on Google, on Spotify, on Ghana, on JioSaavn. Wow, crazy. And of course, if you are watching the video, you can check it out on YouTube and you like, subscribe to the channel. Appreciate it. Now, today, I'm talking to an artist from Bangalore. And why is it important to talk to an artist? Because I feel there's a lot of noise around art right now, right? What you can say, what you should say, how should you say it? What's the medium? What's the preferred medium? Now, of course, with technology in the mix, it's like, how do you create? When should you create? NFTs, all these various things, copyright issues, and you have things where is AI going to take over art? And is it generating all these images which are not real? Is the human potential for creation being taken over by an intelligence which is being artificially created by other human beings? So all these things are relevant. And essentially, as an individual who's an artist today, what is important to you? How do you protect yourself? How do you ensure that what you want to say, the questions you want to ask, the questions you want to kind of contemplate, how do they get told? And how do you tell your story? Or is it just the echo chambers that are being celebrated? Or is it just that what you hear online where it's like, oh, you know, it's only the woke being heard, or it's only these kind of artists that are being celebrated, it's only these agendas that are being pushed? What is the reality? Well, to talk to me about that today, I've got Anuja Gosalkar, who's the founder of Drama Queen. It's a documentary theater company. She's based in Bangalore. She's, of course, also an author. She's a theater artist and a lot more. And we talk a lot about these topics that intrigue me, concern me. So what's the future of art? What can you, as an artist today, look forward to in the near future? And how do you protect yourself as an artist? So many things that we don't understand happen to us before we know it as artists, right? We have these companies who make us sign contracts. We have these individuals who say they'll promote us. And the next thing you know, everything we consider close and near to us is taken away under the guise of contracts, brands, et cetera, et cetera. Great conversation for everyone, including, or maybe especially artists. And I'm sure you'll enjoy this conversation because its relevance is quite, well, timely. And I think essential to address in a time like this where there's so much noise. Let's whisper, let's be subtle, and let's be, as Anuja says it, and you'll hear it, graceful in what we do. Well, thank you as always for tuning into this podcast. I appreciate it. And until next episode, take it easy. Good luck. Cheers. And enjoy the conversation with Anuja Gosalkar. Anuja, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. It's a pleasure having you here.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. Yeah.
Lovely. You know, first of all, I didn't know you were in the audience that day when I cracked that silly joke. So thanks for bringing that up in the email saying, you know, I really thought that was just going into the ether, being unappreciated. But clearly there was someone who, you know, picked up on it and said, is that really water or booze in that bottle of mine? So thanks. I haven't done stand up in a long time. And just hearing that one chuckle takes me a long way. So appreciate that.
I'm glad.
Right. So can I ask you, you know, we were at the same conference, which was Climate Change in Art. Mm-hmm. So in what way were you involved in that? Because, you know, when they called me and said, can you come and speak on this panel as a stand-up mm-hmm. comedian? Mm-hmm. Or in before that, they said, can you perform a stand-up bit? And I said, you know, I don't have customized material for climate mm-hmm. change, right? Even though I don't customize, but at the same time, I felt it might be more interesting to kind of be a part of a panel. So that's how I came there, because I'm curious about conversations with people in different spaces. But in what capacity were you invited to speak at this climate change conference?
No, actually, I wasn't invited to speak. I came as an audience member.
Okay.
I came as an audience member because I'm an artist. I work in performance making, and climate change, you know, is of interest to me. And a friend of mine, his film was showing as part of the climate change festival. So I came to show solidarity to my friend and also to understand what are the conversations around climate change. And this one was especially interesting to me because this was climate change and art. It was not just climate change randomly. So I wanted to see what are the intersections and how are they really thinking about it.
Okay. So, sorry, I didn't know that you were an attendee, which is great. So when you witness something like that, right, as an mm-hmm. artist, we hear about these concepts of the future for our planet can only be salvaged by artists and people who think unconventionally, right? People who are willing to think through resistance, people who are willing mm-hmm. to think through adversity. And a lot of times great art comes through adversity, tragedy, mm-hmm. etc. But what is this power of art? And if you want to maybe define it in the modern context with the way technology has sort of become such an integral part of art, because, you know, you can obviously refer to the likes of the Da Vinci's and the Picasso's and say that's art, or someone else will say, you know, it's the architectural design that defines a cultural context. But just in a sense of where we're sitting today with the ability to create, the ability to also rely on technology to help us create, maybe I wouldn't say a definition, but maybe a sense of what is art for the present day society, and maybe what present day society needs from art.
That's a great question. I think what is art is a very, very big question. My entire life is spent on that quest of what is art. It took me very long to even say that I'm an artist because with what is art comes who is an artist, right?
Yeah.
I decided to say I'm an artist at 34, which was 11 years ago. It took some courage because I think the artist has a great deal of responsibility. They carry on their shoulders. I think they're the conscience of a society that we inhabit. And for me, in a very simple way, the greatest role of the artist is to ask questions. She needs to ask really difficult, radical questions of the mainstream, of the status quo, of people in power, because the journalist has to be sort of, you know, the in-between person who conveys information. But I think it's incumbent on the artist to ask difficult, good questions to the people on one side, so to the audience. So they're making the audience also think and sit up, and on the other side to the powers that rule us. So that is the really critical role of the artist. She becomes the enfant terrible, if you want to call it, or somebody who asks questions to both sides. That's why she's important.
So that sounds like a really important role that art plays, right? Whatever form the art expresses itself in. Now, the difficulty is, you know, and sometimes you can't look at your own reflection because you're uncomfortable with whatever you, the version of you that you see, or rather, I would rephrase that as the version that you choose to not see, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As a result, we find ourselves today where a lot of art is being quashed by both sides, whether certain forces in power don't want mm-hmm. a certain form of expression to be viewed by the public, or maybe even the public saying we don't want to hear this or see this because it's uncomfortable for us, because we're not, we choose to ignore it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, when that happens, these difficult questions go unanswered, and there are only a few questions that get celebrated and repeated mm-hmm. in the circle of art or artists, right?
True.
Because, and I find that dangerous, you know, because I've been off stage for the past 4 years as a stand-up, mm-hmm. and that's by choice, not because of any environment mm-hmm. that stand-up is going through or the cultural context that stand-up is mm-hmm. unable to think, just a personal mm-hmm. choice.
Mm-hmm.
But when I listen to discussions, and stand-up's my space, so I'm more prone to listening to conversations in that space, there's this perception, I don't know if it's the reality, but the perception that there are few places where you shouldn't go as topics for a stand-up comedian to crack jokes on, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it may be, you know, and for me, the primary thing, whether I'm a conservative or a woke comedian, whether I'm a male or a female mm-hmm. comedian, whether I'm a comedian who's marginalized or Indian or whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
I think the primary thing for a comedian, spoken word artist, is to make people laugh. Mm-hmm. Now, the medium is laughter. The topics can be more serious. The questions can be uncomfortable. But when the pool of questions themselves are limited, I feel that's a little dangerous to art. So I want to know what your thoughts on that are.
That's a good way of looking at it, that questions themselves can be limiting because the questions can lead you. We have leading questions, questions that take you or force you to answer. Sometimes questions can feel like they're interrogations.
Yeah.
I agree with you that questions can create a tunnel vision that even the artist herself may not see. But I also, you know, Sandeep, I think our audiences are very clever. The minute we start to corner them, there is a kind of pushback, whether the pushback is in that they will not laugh, or whether the pushback is that they will not receive your work in a way that you want them to receive. I think the audience is way smarter than artists give them credit for. And this is not just a ticket buying audience. Mm-hmm. I feel this relationship gets fraught when the artist or the performer and the audience has a transactional relationship. If they have a relationship that's not just on the ticket pricing, now you entertain me,
mm-hmm.
it would be much more interesting to see if the artist is responsible for what she's saying. The audience can ask questions back. Then it becomes slightly more complicated and complex. And actually, a lot of times when you do live performances, the audience will tell you if they like your line of questioning, if they don't. You know, hooting, clapping, whistling are all signs of feedback in the moment. So not for a moment am I saying that the artist alone should ask questions and she should not be questioned, not at all. But with the live arts, especially stand-up or theater, it's very fine. You can start to tell if somebody yawns, if someone looks down, you're getting feedback every second. So I also believe, I should add the caveat that I also believe that the audience has great agency. If they choose to walk out and leave or clap or applaud, is already telling the artist if her questions are good, bad, uncomfortable. So yeah, you hit the nail on its head. And I do think the audience has agency. They can ask questions back as they should. Yeah.
Because, you know, growing up for the longest mm-hmm. time, there was a certain style of theater which was inspired by the West End, you know, it would either be a Shakespeare production. And a lot of the old school artists, theater artists, would be inspired from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And that's changed now to a lot more regional adaptations, a lot more performances in regional languages, which is a great sign for a society, right? To hear your stories in your own language and to kind of bring that back to life, you know, whether it's the story of Tagore or whether it's whatever the play may be about or maybe the performance is about. So I'm purely from the school of thought that sometimes if I don't agree with something, I want to watch a performance about it, you know, if I don't know enough about it. And I mm-hmm. feel that's the responsibility where the artist is like, this is the topic that I want to talk about, whether it's my interest in wildlife or this is my interest in in child development or in special children with special needs, and I want to do a play about it, or I want to talk about family disputes or domestic abuse. And it's uncomfortable, right, for anyone to watch that, because especially if you haven't witnessed it firsthand, hearing these stories is essential for a society to talk about these things. You go out of the play or you go out of the performance saying, you know what? But what I find sometimes a little scary, I'm not saying representing for, this is a question on behalf of all artists, but just, isn't it good to have everything spoken about and discussed as an artist? Everything, like, because that represents all aspects of humanity. Now, whether it's, you know, someone talking about the plight of the Hijra community, or the someone talking about the plight of the red light district in Calcutta. Now, one is educational. Second is also bringing uncomfortable topics to the forefront, right? Like, because talking about human trafficking through art is, I think, so important, right? I mean, one is in a, I mean, art could be anything, could be a book, a lecture, could be a documentary, could be a play. Yeah. And by
a song, yeah.
By a song, exactly. And I sometimes just find nowadays, is there a certain tendency to celebrate a set of topics and say the artist who spoke about that is great, while demonizing certain artists for talking about something. Now, I don't know whether it's politicized, whether it's the right and the left, and I don't want to speculate, but what do you feel over the course of the years you've been doing this? Has there been a certain leniency and a certain encouragement of certain spaces and topics and a certain demonization of others?
Yes, of course, there are topics that are demonized and certain topics are celebrated. But Sandeep, I also think, because I think that's largely because either side, all sides are in very thick echo chambers. We only want to hear what we want to hear.
Yeah.
We do not want to hear the other side. And what you said earlier, shouldn't art ask questions? Shouldn't we all be talking? The simple answer is yes. I think everybody is shouting, especially on social media. again, on both sides, on every side, everybody is shouting. Nobody is listening.
Yeah.
Whether it's talking about a certain kind of injustice, whether it's talking about war, whether it's talking about poverty, everyone is shouting. I wish for a moment somebody would sit and listen. And if theater or music creates that space where I can be quiet and listen to the other, or listen to the other side, I think we'll move forward. And the other danger I have with this notion of safe, you know, safety is art is also meant to take risks. If I'm always going to tread on what is safe for me, how will I ever get exposed to something new? It's not to say that, you know, people who are differently abled or women should feel attacked in the spaces there. That's not what I mean at all. I mean that we also need to shake ourselves out of the echo chambers that we are in, whether it's social media echo chambers, whether it's WhatsApp, or whether it's our building societies. But if there is a space, whether it's a music concert, I can hear something that someone else is saying, which I may not agree with. I think that sight is exciting, because if we don't listen to the other, there's a danger that we'll only be hearing our own voice.
You know, and that's the important an important word you mentioned, safe, right?
Yeah.
Now, I feel that's taken out of context, because, you know, if you ask me now, was it better in the 90s for as a person who's visually impaired, or 2024? I would say, of course, you know, there is so much more advancement with accessibility, technology. And also awareness, right? People are willing to kind of give you a chance in some way. Even back then, people gave you a chance, but it's now under the guise of political correctness. They might not say the things they want to say. But having said that, when it comes to safe places, you know, I want to go to an example like performing at the Fringe in Edinburgh. It was safe. You know, there was no one going to brutalize me because I'm a blind guy from India doing a show. When I'm flying, no one came and attacked me saying, how dare you do this? Or or when you enter a theater as a woman, you know that whatever is going to happen at 7 in the evening, 9:30 in the evening, it's safe in the typical sense of the word, right?
Yeah.
No one's going to come and harass you, and no man's going to come and hit on you or make you uncomfortable. So that way it's safe. But now it's gone to a place where anything you listen to, you have a trigger warning. Like any podcast you listen to, it might trigger you, right? And my point is that taking safety too far? Because as long as I know I'm physically safe, I'm not going to fall off the ramp into Dante's Inferno, if I know that I'm that safe, or if I know, oh my God, in the middle of this, I need to pee. These are real, concerns, when you don't know where the closest toilet to the exit is. It is a little anxiety provoking for someone who's in a wheelchair or someone who can't see or someone who's dependent. That kind of safety, right? You know where your things are, someone's going to help you come in, come out, or, the physical safety is ensured. But intellectual safety or emotional or ideological safety, are these essential when you attend a performance?
That's a very complicated question, because the answer cannot be yes and no for this one.
Yeah.
The short answer would be yes, I would like to feel safe, because it's only from a place of safety can I even create something that questions something, or it's from a place of extreme being taken care of. Maybe safety is an extreme word. Maybe as an artist, I'm taken care of by society, by my family, by my friends. From that care, I can make work that is risky, provocative, strong. So I would say I cannot answer this as a blanket yes and no.
Of course.
Because I also Sandeep, I work with people who feel unsafe just stepping out of their homes because of the language they speak, because of their religion, because of how they appear, because how their genders present. So for me to say that no, every environment should be a bold, risk-taking one, no, I can't say that. Mm-hmm. Should there be a basic level of safety for all people of all kinds of margins? Yes. But from that, can we build a space where you have taken care of me, so society is taking care of me, and from there, I can build a set of a questioning attitude. I think that's what I would say, because I can't say safety for all. There's no such thing as the space is safe for all of us. It isn't. What is safe for me will certainly not be safe for you. What might be safe for you is not desirable for me. So I would think it's a pendulum, it's a graph, it's many colors blotting together, it's many shades. And that question has to be answered by each individual in a different context. Like in this space of the podcast with you on Zoom just now, I feel incredibly safe because I'm in my home. I have the agency or the power to turn this off if I get asked an uncomfortable question. I don't know if the same was true if I'd be in a live show with 100 people pushing me. So it would change. So it is context specific, it is situation specific, and it depends on the individual and how they feel. But I would say, rather than safety, can we say that we create a environment of care? And from that care, we either make bold risk-taking work, or we make work that is gentle and at least gives us a voice.
Yeah, I think that's well put, because, if I take you back to 2010, as a comedian, there's this, let's be risky, right? Let's do dark humor. And under the guise of that, you just say stupid shit, right? and I'm saying this as someone who maybe, who might have done it, but when... Now I kind of go watch a comedian, or when I put on that hat, I'm like, what is the reason for that, right? Is it just to say, I can crack a rape joke, right? To be that one cool guy that people are like, he's anti-establishment. But I'm like, no, because see, the thing is that I haven't experienced it. I have nothing funny to say about it. So I'm thinking it through as a creator. Say I go for a show and someone's just being obnoxious about it because they're like, I have a mic, I can say whatever the fuck I want on stage because freedom of speech, it turns me off because there's no humor there. They're not doing it well. But when I watch someone really good at their craft, build up a sense of, come along with me in this journey, I'll take you where I want to. And it's done well, because even as a stand-up comedian, even though just a mic and words, you can build a beautiful journey where you can go to places which you wouldn't want to typically go to because it's not interesting, or it's something which might make you uncomfortable. But when they do it well, that's the trick, and that's the beauty of the art, right? Even as a playwright or a director.
I mean, you used a great word, craft.
Yeah. I mean, and I feel a lot of the craft is gone now because it's almost like you're not willing to give a chance to the craft. The moments are, and as a result, it's reactionary, right? The audience is like, how dare you? And the performer's like, I'll show you. And that's, that I feel is detrimental to the art.
I would partially agree with that because I also feel that getting on stage and using a string of bad, like bad words, a lot of people laugh at it. But I find that like, what is its intention, right? Intention
it's a tool. Is a very, what is it serving? Yeah.
What is it serving? Because intention is a very important question in art. Is your intention to provoke me to do something about it? Is your intention to just attack me because you're on stage and you have the power to attack me?
Yeah.
So the intention question is very important. Sometimes I get irritated with comedy or things where people are just using a string of bad language to no impact, to no effect.
Yeah.
What is its impact? Why are you doing it? Does it shake me out of anything or do you just reascertain the status quo already? And I think, Sandeep, in the arts, whether it's stand-up comedy, whether it's music, theater, film, I think there has to be a certain grace. And by grace, I don't mean beauty necessarily. Like you can be really strong and hard-hitting, but there's a grace towards your audience.
Would that be also something you would use with replay, interchange with dignity? The word grace?
I mean, it is, yes, you're right. I mean, they could be the same, the two sides of the same coin, but I feel like a grace to say that, okay, I disagree with you and I'll still clap, or the performer saying that, oh, the audience didn't clap at me, but I will still give them grace and continue with my joke, something like that.
I think
dignity we all have. When I go on stage, I have a whole lot of dignity. The audience walks in, sits on the first row. They already have that dignity. But a grace of disagreement. Like I see too many stand-up comedians making fun of people for the sake of it. And also too many audience members dissing the person on stage because they may not fully understand what the person's saying. I feel grace on both sides. And grace in social media as well, because people are like attacking you. Again, it comes to shouting. Can I be
that's
graceful enough?
Translating to the live shows. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I think that's the reason I asked is because there is a dignity in the way you present your dissatisfaction or your reaction, you know? And I see and hear this sometimes. And again, this my point of reference comes back to stand up. And again, this could be, you know, fill in the blank here. It could be even an art gallery owner or whatever, right? If they're displaying certain artists who are controversial, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Or even the way J.K. Rowling has to defend herself when she has certain views on women's rights, and the attack that she comes under is just crazy. But what I mean by the way it's changed for me is that it's almost, as you said, it's shouting, right? Very antagonist. Like when you look at, say, you know, shows that have been created which are purely for viewership, like American Idol or X Factor or The Voice. In many cases, there's no grace in it, right? And that's, I think that's really well identified by you. The word grace is, you know, it's brought into this light where, oh, you know, they build this story. He was a homeless person till 50, and then he one day was singing out, saying, save me from garbage. And Simon Cowell found him, you know, some crap thing. So I find that even in comedy, like, you know, someone is telling me like now if four people come for the show, and it's a lineup of 10 comedians at an open mic, they all start going like, oh, you know, the sense of entitlement, like I deserve a bit bigger crowd. And what are you four doing here? And they automatically start like crapping on the audience. I'm like, what are you doing? Like you should be grateful that you have four. I mean, because four laughing clearly tells that 100 will laugh, or it's a sign of the fact that, you know, you have people. And that was not there 10, 12 years ago when we started out. I wouldn't say we're the most grateful people back then, but we would appreciate every room because, you know, we didn't have rooms that would say, you know, come in freely for stand up. But now since it's on Netflix and Amazon, there's this entire shift. You know, which happened for music many years back. Again, now musicians are humbled by the fact that, you know, my God, they have a time for the biggest platforms for music, yet the independent artist is getting screwed over, right? And I think every art goes through its highlight and again crash and again comes up and goes down. So, but yeah, I mean, I don't have a question. I'm just kind of trying to understand the landscape of where we are as creators, because on one side now, a person creating beautiful, say, fine art is not given as much importance as, say, a YouTube content creator who's in their own universe, a celebrity, you know? And then you have these influencers who call themselves artists, but what are they using as art, right? Is it the filters on Instagram, or is it the art of making something really short and catchy in 40 seconds, or creating something that can go viral, which people can copy? Like, clearly, you know, sometimes that's why I asked you up top, but what is art now? Because someone trying to do a bucket dance and that going viral is, you know.
But Sandeep, yeah, sure. Like for me, see, this is, how do I say, because if a large number of people enjoy it, right? For a long time, it is, I mean, I'll tell you, it took me so long to call myself an artist, because to be an artist, to say I'm an artist is also a slightly elitist position, right? It is a privileged position to say who's an artist, because it takes a lot. It takes a lot financially. It takes a lot in terms of craft. And who am I to say somebody else is not an artist?
That I agree with. But why is an artist perceived? And I'm not disagreeing. I'm asking you, why is an artist seen as a privileged position, or a position of elitism?
I mean, if I'm saying it's a position of elitism, if I say I'm an artist and you're not.
When I start
to say only I'm an artist, like talking about the YouTubers, and I've thought of that quite a lot. I consume all of it. I watch a lot of YouTube. I also TikTok. So here's how I'm positioning it. So I think everybody should be an artist.
Yeah.
But in training, you will be like, no, but only some people have the craft to tell a story well, have the craft to make good music. And therefore, only some people are artists and some others are not. And as a young person, maybe I thought of it like that as well. And this is true of, let's say, classical music. You learn classical music for 22 years, 30 years, and then you're like, I will go and sing a song. They train heavily, and the others who sing pop music or do karaoke are not artists. Now, I think that has changed in the last 7 to 8 years because of social media, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
I think it has taken us closer to the population, to the common person. And I want to imagine that that's also allowed, that's also legitimate, because the minute I or somebody like myself or like us becomes a purveyor of what is art, what is not, there's a censorship, there is a hierarchy. And the one thing that I do not ever want to become is the person who becomes a gatekeeper of hierarchy.
Absolutely. In that position, I got what you meant by elitist.
Because then there might be a danger that we lose something. That we say more like it's only people like us. And when you start saying people like us, that's very dangerous.
That when it becomes these terms being thrown around like nepotism, only certain people who have access get to create, which I think the internet has done a great job of, you know, leveling the playing field. In fact, I think it's swung to the other side now, where if you are coming from this as an outlier, or from the outfield, from a place earlier not accepted, you are in fact more celebrated, because I think that's just how the pendulum swings, right? There is a certain overcorrection that happens when for years it's only a few people and their cousins and their kids who get a chance to create, especially say Bollywood or the film industry. And you see that, which is great.
And I also hear the other side, because I see the amount of, amount of not good material there is out there, and not good is putting it gently.
You mean the bullshit that people pass off as comedy? Yeah, I can say, don't worry about it. If you don't feel like saying it, I'll say it.
The crap that you're
forced to consume under the guise of humor is absolute trash.
Yeah, the tribe there is like humor, there's content, like, and I also feel that there's a danger to that. There's a danger when you just put on your camera and are ranting, and it's reaching millions of people. Because the young person who's 13 years old watching it and you saying something against women or a certain community has an impact. That's what I meant by intention. What is your intention? There's a great book called The H-Bomb, written by Kunal Purohit. It's about pop in a certain kinds of pop music, pop poetry, and pop publishing in a world that is small town India, that is Hindi speaking, and the impact it has. A song can go viral overnight. So I think I say this with caution, that of course it should be open to everyone, but at the same time, the amount of influence, and that word influencer is actually not to be used lightly.
And that's what scares me, right? When you have someone today promoting, maybe it's a pretty woman or a fit guy or whatever it may be, right? And today they're talking about how they got fit, which is their story, which they're absolutely entitled to talk about. But tomorrow they're promoting weight loss powders. Tomorrow they're promoting this thing about anti-animal cruelty. I'm like, okay, these are good messages. But how, you know, when that power goes to your head, next thing, what path will you go down? And you spoke about this messaging, you know, like people talk about how the black population in America was oppressed for many years, which, you know, again, I'm not an expert. I don't want to go down that path. But
when they were oppressed, I mean, that is true. I mean,
not about, of course, the oppression. Yes. Right. No, what I'm talking about, the resulting reactionary movement. I'm not, of course, you know, I'm not going to be a slavery denier because
exactly.
What I meant by I don't want to go down that path is that that's a very deep and, you know, it's a conversation for another day. But when it doesn't mean you can excuse the messaging in certain rap songs, you know, the ones filled with violence and hate and against, whether it's against women, whether it's against police, whether it's this thing. I'm just saying, where do we draw the line, right? Because someone can say, yeah, but they experience it, so they have to talk about it. And as a result, if you have it now through people watching those YouTube videos of those rap songs or those lyrics being played over and over again because of access through these platforms, and someone says, I'm going to do that by doing it in Bengali or Hindi. So it is still art, and I would not like to censor that. But what does that involve, right? Because as you said, it if it's repeatedly being played to an uninformed mind, an immature mind, say someone who's 45 sitting in an IT company. I wouldn't say young, I'd say immature, who's 45 sitting, say, you know. And I think that's, again, like, do I, again, I'm not the gatekeeper, as you rightly pointed out, none of us should be the gatekeeper. But you have someone now saying, oh, because this movie had, you know, five F words, we're going to censor it. But someone showing something inflammatory under the guise of ideological progress, they would say, you know, what should and what shouldn't be censored, or should anything at all be censored?
I mean, from an artistic point of view, and idealistically, I would say things should not be censored. But I work with young people, so I also know the kind of impact some kind of lyrics have, or some kind of art, or popular culture, let's say. I think that's a much more better word for this kind of conversation that we're having about these particular things can have. You know, Sandeep, I'd like to say that censorship is not good for us, because censorship can go either way. If I say censorship is okay, tomorrow my words will be curtailed. That day won't be far. I don't think it is far where a sort of liberal persona like mine will be curtailed. So I'll put myself out there and say there should not be censorship of any type. But what we need to do as a society, as people who are responsible for young people or immature people or minds that you know, or even ourselves, is that we need to have mechanisms in society that allow us to make decisions that are good for us, that allow us to exercise our agency. I keep coming back to that word because I do deeply believe in, like, each individual's will to make the decision, because for the large part they should have it, or we create a space where individuals make their own decisions. So I would say we create circumstances around it that allow young people or just people to make well-informed decisions, because with censorship there is a great danger. Because if I say today censorship should be allowed, then I'm no different from the other side that says, yeah, of course, you then I tell you, you don't talk.
It's like the you know what you in 1984, the George Orwell book, like, you can only watch this movie which the state allows, right?
Exactly. So I would still go and say, no, we should not have censorship, but we need a lot of good social fabric. We need good material in the, how to say, in the soil, to nurture this kind of independent thinking. And then if you still go ahead and make those decisions, then well, yeah. Just to close this point, that's the thing about free will, right? That's the thing about both of us having choice. I will make the choice I will make, and so will you. Should I crucify you for that? My answer would be no.
Okay. No, well said. I think because this point you made about grace, I'm still thinking about it. And I really like it. That's why I asked whether it's dignity, because in my head, there's a dignified way of doing things, you know. Or as, you know, my mom's generation would say, very cultured. You know, I don't know. I never understood what that meant, but very cultured
me
person.
Me neither.
He's a member of the club, very cultured. Like, he goes home and beats his dog, but very cultured.
That's class related. Thank you for bringing that up. I don't mean grace as a classy thing at all.
Yeah.
Everybody, and maybe it's connected to dignity, of course.
I think classy is also something that needs a change in the way it's looked at, right? Because just because someone's from IIT Madras and I am Bangalore and they have a job and they attend the art gala,
it doesn't mean
classy at
all.
Now there's people with the most money or the most unclassy people. And that's why when you said grace, I was also asking dignity, because there's...
I just want to say one thing when you said class and money, because you see how many big cars there are in Bangalore, right? Yeah. And yet how many people are flouting traffic rules and how many people are honking. Ergo, I mean, money and the class you come from actually is not connected to a grace at all. Just wanted to finish.
No, absolutely. You know, because there are people with a love for cars who will be as graceful in a car or as in a rickshaw. But you know what I find with this notion of money is that, you know, there is or was a certain notion that if you charge, say, 5,000 rupees for a ticket, the people who come for your shows will be of a classy audience. And someone, in fact, said once, Sandeep, when you're branding yourself, who's your audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And typically the amount of money comes, right? Because if you charge 99 rupees, you'll get riffraff. Mm. If you charge 5,000, you'll get the creme de la creme of Bangalore. And I'm like, I don't want the creme de la creme because it's not defined by money.
No.
In fact, it's defined by the theater where you have the thing, because it attracts that kind of person. Now, we can keep, you know, how much we price points as a conversation for maybe a little later. But this idea of grace is, you know, when I haven't watched too many movies in my life, but say when I watched Pulp Fiction, right? Let's just go to that example. It's some of the most gruesome scenes, right? But would you say someone like Quentin Tarantino, as someone we know, as a dear friend? Like, I don't know, you know, I'm just trying to understand, because when now with the sort of the democratization of filmmaking, where anyone with a YouTube account and a camera and a need to tell a story can do it, which I think is great. But one extreme you have that, like other extreme you have the likes of your Martin Scorsese or the legends in Hollywood. Again, I feel like how you said, if someone just picks up a camera and says, let's just make a movie which is anti-Brahmin, anti-Muslim, anti-women, they can do that. And YouTube will host the movie, unless, of course, it's flagged for really violent scenes. But it doesn't mean just because you can, you should. Or can you?
Wow. Just because you can, you should. Let me reframe this, okay? My question to people who can, who do because they can, is that can I become an engineer? Can I go build a car? Can I operate on somebody? I cannot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have the craft, like we were saying earlier. I don't have the skills to become an engineer. I can't code, but I can study code quickly. So in the same way, I don't know why when it comes to art, people think like, okay, I can also do it.
Yeah. Just because I can.
Yeah, just because I can.
I find that a little scary, because there is a process to it, you know? Sorry, not to interrupt, but just to...
Not because I'm always worried, you know, Sandhya, that I say that I'm an artist or not. And that's not what I'm saying at all. It does take time. It requires a certain investment of your energy, of like skill. But I have friends who will disagree with me and say, no, everyone's an artist. And art is not like science, which is also valid, right? Art is
I don't
not
think so, economics. You know, because when you don't put in the time... When you don't put in the time to your art, you're doing a disgrace to it. You're doing a disgrace to the people. I'll give you an example, and this is personal, and of course it hurts to talk about it because, I mean, it doesn't hurt like trauma, but it is pretty close to it. I put together a show back in, I forget, 2016, 17, because I was doing stand-up for about 7 years by then. I had done 3 years of improv, and I was like, you know what, let's do sketch comedy. So I wrote this show along with this guy called Export Rejects, right? And we decided to go put the script together. I kind of wrote it and we rehearsed it in my house and he said, let's just put it up at Jagriti.
Oh, nice. Okay.
In Bangalore. I mean, we got it because of my reputation as a stand-up comedian. Jagdish and Arundhati were really sweet to give me a slot on a Wednesday, I think.
They are very nice people.
Lovely people, right? Yeah. And lovely, as you said, safe, encouraging place. After the show, I was like, please don't ever give me a stage for this show or this kind, because I did it injustice, you know. There were a couple of scenes which were funny, but I was like, this was totally unprepared as a sketch performer. I had no business doing it. But then on the flip side, about six of us came together, put this show called The IT Show. For short, it was called Tits. And we did, I know, very, very cheap thrills.
Very,
it was six comedians putting together a sketch show, but not in its thing, but it was such a laugh because we did it as stand-up comedians without taking ourselves seriously. So I realized that's where grace is, right? The performance, the due process. And I hadn't done the script justice, I hadn't done the rehearsal justice. And that's when, if I say, just because I can, I should, and because of my relationship with them as a comedian, I got a stage to perform, I shouldn't have done it. And that's where I self-check myself.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's great.
And I feel that's where it's important. Yeah, because, you know, when you go watch, say, you know, a musical and you get inspired by it and saying, I can, then do the damn due diligence to put in the work. Because then you see, you know, as I said, I've been for a few plays which have come from at the Chowdhury, and, you know, you get to say, oh, they can do it, I can do it. Okay, but, you know, there should be amount of self-check.
Yes, there should be self-check. And I wanted to say that this thing about, because I can, I should, is not just doctors, engineers, professions that are sort of like white collar, but it's also, I can't be a carpenter. I don't
know. Oh my God, it's one of the hardest things. Yeah,
it's a hard skill. I can't be a plumber. I don't have those skills. I can't cook as well as my partner can or as my mother can. So it's not just to privilege it to white collar things. And the second thing, what you're saying is, we also have to, as artists, know when to say no. Yeah. Like, it's very important to say no. This is not my cup of tea, or no, I will not do it.
Yeah.
Because it's very, very cool of you to say that, oh, you should not have done it. Maybe it's not as bad as you're saying it is. But also the reverse.
No, trust me, it was disastrous.
Okay, fine. I believe that then. But
okay, let me give you, just because we're on that point. You know how that ended? That six sketches ended with two of us wearing wigs and air guitaring with a computer keyboard and a broom to Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. It was that bad.
Okay. I need to see it to believe it. I won't take your word for it.
It's never going to happen again.
No, never going to. Okay, good. But good that you said this is not for me. Because I think that's important. Because even as people who are creative people, and I think that's also the proliferation of, like, because I can do it, I'll sing also, I'll make a YouTube video, I'll do stand-up comedy, I'll be a health coach, or what is it called, lifestyle guru, and evangelist of how people should lead their lives. Because there is money. Because what you were saying earlier, you know, Sandeep, I think all of this is also connected to this whole capitalist system that we all are part of. Like, if the influencer tells me that, okay, go exercise, it's good for you, or go meditate or eat healthy, I can take it if it's not followed by an advertisement, or if it's not for, you know, sponsored by good nutrition or whatever. I'm making up this product.
Or by Healthify Me. Yeah.
Yeah, you said it. I did. So anything.
They're not on the podcast, I can say.
Okay, good. So if every message of mine is connected to a product, then I'm going to be very suspicious.
Yeah.
And I think that's another layer of danger of this proliferation of, like, let's make a music video, let's dance, let's make TikTok, sponsored by, like you're saying, Healthify or something. Because then, is your voice, is your message your own? Or is it controlled by something far bigger that you don't even know exists?
Yeah. And this is the problem where it's kind of a cycle, right? To get to a place where your art can sustain you now, especially with the YouTube creators. you know, they create a bunch of videos, and God bless the skill, right? It's very hard. At least some of the guys at the level they've got it up to. It's amazing. Whether mm-hmm. it's tech review videos, whether it's these vlogs, which are mm-hmm. amazingly well shot, produced, absolutely. And written,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Now, to sustain that, they, you know, as soon as they can, need sponsorship, right? Whether yeah, it's someone to endorse the video. True. And then they enter the space of branded content. Now, it's literally, you know, this, I'm shooting it on this sofa. This sofa is brought to you by IKEA or whatever it may be, right? And the next thing you know, I'm obviously haven't done branded content before in my videos, but so where, and that's the thing, because you need money to create art.
True.
You know,
that's
and
true. Yeah.
So that's another fine line, because yeah, you can't, you know, it's not like the earlier days where a king would be your patron and you can just create art. And how long will you take with this painting? 45 years, you're a lord. And yeah. Take your time, you know.
That's a good point. There is a tension between livelihood, sustenance, making your YouTube videos. Yes, I also find myself struggling. Should I be taking this funder's money to make a theater show? Should I be taking Indian money? Should I be taking foreign money? Absolutely. It's and yet the truth is we do need money, not to live a good life, but even just if I have to support my mother, if I have to buy medical insurance. But you are right. People do need money. And who am I to say that they shouldn't have that?
Yeah, no, and I don't demonize anyone for doing the money thing. Yeah, yeah.
The funny thought came to me when they said the sofa you're sitting on is IKEA. I mean, there's a fantastic film called The Truman Show.
Yeah, of course.
Everything Truman does is sponsored. He's living in a big fat advertisement.
That's a great movie. Yes. No, and I think that's where we're heading.
Exactly.
Because when I watch these golf influencers, right, these kids who are damn good at golf, they haven't turned pro yet. And they do all these really well shot videos. They're giving you good golf tips. But then you should see one day they're in Hawaii. One day they're in in some other exotic destination. Everything, their clubs are paid for. Their air tickets are paid for. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be. Mm. But if you look at then in art, when I come back to the example of stand-up, will it ever, you know, when you have shows like the Comic Stun and those kind of huge endorsed Amazon original comedy shows.
Yeah.
I think there is a little restriction on what you can say because there are lawyers involved. And the moment lawyers are involved, nothing good happens. yes, I did say it. And because
that's true. You're very right about that. You're very, very, I agree with you there. Yeah.
And that's scary, right? Because I wouldn't say scary. Again, I'm using the word scary quite often, and I don't mean the word scary in its true sense, but it is a little disconcerting or a little concerning when everything you say is being documented and written off, and your lawyers, again, you know, it's needed. You can't just say, I'm not going to go through lawyers. The next thing you know, everything you take. I'll give you an example again without naming names.
Already named two, which was remarkable, but yes.
Oh, no, that's the brands. It's fine. I don't think they're ever going to endorse this podcast. So it's fine. You know?
Okay.
But now the reason why I say it is also because when I was on Indigo, the radio station, I was doing the evening show and I had to give these shout outs for these ads. And I didn't agree with a lot of them. Like one of these tech water parks, these amusement parks was run by this guy who culls dogs in Kerala. And I was like, how do I say no, right? It was awful, but anyway, that's when I'm not going to name names, because from dogs to culling me, not very far step for him. but I was asked to do this show once by this guy in India, this producer, and he made me sign an NOC. So obviously I don't want to go down into the details. And because I was wiser about the contractual stuff, I said, let's talk about whatever you talk about over the phone. But when it comes to PayPal and signing anything, this is where lawyers are amazing, you know?
Yes, excellent. Plus one to what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah. And this is again for artists listening, right? Because I know so many artists who got signed onto these big projects because of the glamour of it. And next thing, when they actually sat down and looked at the contract, they were screwed over because nothing they had to say belonged to them anymore. Dangerous world. So this is where lawyers are amazing. But again, lawyers created it so they can have more money for themselves when they have to be consulted on it, right? It's great. But this guy said something which I found great. And this is because I could laugh at the situation because I wasn't, contractually obliged. He said, man, I'm getting you on this podcast, which had to do something with my eyes, right? It was as a host who can't see. And he said, you know, you realize you're nobody as an artist right now. You need me as a producer to take you to where you need to be. And I can replace you any day with a guy wearing sunglasses pretending to be blind.
Gosh.
And no. I mean, great, right? Good. And I was like, how long can you pull that shit off on today's day and age? Not for more than a second.
No.
Because that's where it's a good thing. People are able to call bullshit. Yes. Exactly. As you said, the audiences are smart. They're not going to. And I think that's great.
Yeah. And Sandeep, to talk about your thing about the contracts. Thank you for bringing it up. A lot of artists sign contracts without reading them.
Yeah.
Stop doing that.
Yeah,
I'll tell you why. And not just the Amazon Primes of the world. I work with even smaller arts funding organizations. Okay. Mm-hmm. And my independent artist grants are nothing close to what commercial money is. But I will tell you that if you read the clauses, you most often give up your intellectual property to a theater play I may have made, a script I may have written. So always go through the contract, especially look at intellectual property, look at indemnity and liabilities, because if the play does well, or if the play gets into trouble, the liability sometimes is entirely yours. So if there's a court case, you are alone, left alone in the lurch. And the third thing I'll say is, when you start asking contractual questions back to the people who have either commissioned your work or given you an artist's grant, it cuts them open. So while on the surface their politics is for the artist, for the collective, the minute the artist says who owns intellectual property, see them cower. Mm. And they get very afraid. I have had somebody who said, this is too complicated for us to answer, when I said, a lawyer will read my contract. I want to retain the intellectual property of my work. And again, I'm saying the work I do is minuscule. Yeah. So ask questions of the contract.
And always ensure that someone in your batch is a lawyer.
Absolutely.
So if you can't afford the legal fees, have lawyer friends.
I hold on to them. Absolutely right. That's my strategy. And in those cases is what I was saying earlier, be willing to say no. You have to also be willing to walk away and say, okay, this is great money. This is great exposure, whatever that word means. But it is not in the best interest of the art I'm making.
No, Anuja, that was so important for you to address. And I think that's why I brought it up as well, is the 2021 me who rejected this entire deal because I could stand on my own 2 feet with my dignity. And I could do it because I was more well-informed. I had my lawyer friend who had spoken to me about this. Mm. But the same guy 10 years earlier would have jumped at it, right? Because the way it was pitched to me, like, you will be international. We will be doing gigs here. We'll be doing this. But I was like, no. So that was a big growth as an artist for me, that moment when I said no to it.
Yes. And it's happened to me when somebody asked me to produce a podcast, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was very lucrative and I was very excited. I also recorded one pilot for a very big online platform. And then I started to understand copyright. I understood the risk that was entirely mine. And I, even though they had paid for the pilot, I said, let me pay you back. It would have meant very exciting things, but it also meant that the artists I was working with, so I was producing and directing it, but I was going to collect stories of people from the community. It meant putting them, at risk. So one had to walk away from it. And sometimes you have to say no. And it also tells you the niyat, the intention of the conglomerate or of the corporation.
Yeah. No, it's amazing that we've had this chance to discover without getting our fingers burnt too much, you know, because we see the glory and the glamour and getting signed on by the biggest agencies in the world. And then you hear these stories of Metallica getting, you know, signed on in the 1980s and all these things. And like, then you hear Taylor Swift re-recording all her songs because she wants to own her IP, which is one of the most brilliant moves by an artist, right?
Excellent.
But she could do it because she had the money already.
Exactly. Yeah.
Before we started recording, you said, what's the idea behind this podcast, right? And I was very vague about it. And that's when I realized now sometimes it works out in an interesting way, because I can bring back this example I'm going to tell you now and put that vagueness in context. When I was going through these years as a comedian, you want these benchmarks, these moments of validation, right? Whether it's getting representation through an agent or a manager. The second step is getting a big agency to sign you on. The other thing is to get movie offers. The other thing is to get like world tours organized. The other thing is to get Netflix, Amazon, get these big specials on there. None of them happened for me. You know, I went through 2-3 individuals who were supposed to be my manager. They didn't come through. Then none of the big agencies in India took me up because I was based in Bangalore. So Then when I pitched my special to Netflix, they said no. Amazon said no. YouTube didn't have a choice because they're free to upload on, right? So now when I look back, and then this final contract thing, which I rejected in 2021, and then I got the Spotify original series, which I did in 2020. Now, when I look back at these things, I would have loved all of that to go my way. I would have loved a good manager. I would love to be signed on by a big agency. I would love Netflix to buy my special. I would, but sitting here today doing this podcast individually, self-produced, I'm like, thank God I didn't get signed on by anyone, because I would have probably been at the mercy of them saying you have to do these shows to, you know, earn your worth by being on our roster. Doing the Spotify thing was a great idea and great experience to be, you know, working with them, getting my podcast produced and put on their platform. But it also showed me that you're at their at the mercy of their discretion. They're like, no, this episode's too long, cut it by 2 minutes, you have to cut it down, because the contracts on their team are so big, their legal teams, you know. So sitting there today, the, you know, the way things, it didn't pan out the way I wanted, but I'm so glad it didn't. So that's why I'm saying, you know, that's the weird
more,
way.
More power to you. Yeah, more power to you, because it takes a certain amount of courage. It also takes a certain amount to say that, no, I will reach lesser people, because I know especially in stand-up, numbers are a big deal. In theater, we always have small numbers. But this year for myself, I'm building a musical, because everybody keeps saying to me, your practice is so niche. It is so intimate. So this year I want to make a, I don't know, 3,000-seater musical. It's never happening.
If you need an opening act as a comedian, I'm always there.
maybe I'll take you up on that. But more power to you, Sandeep. Really, it's hard. Because
it's very hard. Very hard, because you feel like you're being left behind as everyone zooms past you.
Yeah, very true. And,
but that's what I said, right? When in the beginning, before you look back and you say, oh, you know, it made sense now. But if you kind of let go and trust in yourself, which you don't see in the moment, the plans you put for yourself sometimes might get you into trouble or might not be the plans that are meant for you. But if you just let kind of things happen to you and take everything as a learning and take even rejection and adversity as a learning, which is not easy, again, none of these things are easy. Then when you kind of sit at the cusp, not cusp, but you sit in 10 years down the line and look back, you're like, what a brilliant journey. You know, it's tough though.
It is very tough. What do you turn to Sandeep, when you feel really low in the moment? Because what you're saying, I suppose, to our age group makes sense. But to younger people, they want to see returns very quickly. It's hard for them to say no. What is it, something that you individually say, ah, okay, I've said no to this. I feel low today, but ah, I feel good about X. In the moment, how do you console yourself?
I think I still feel like that. You know, at times when you know, you kind of I've committed to, say I'm doing the podcast now, I have, you know, 2 years I've invested time-wise. I've put in a dedicated episode. Every week I dedicate to putting out an episode. And still it's not the results that I would like, you know. I think the things that really help me are having a set of people I trust who, I think the first thing is, why am I doing this? Because I got caught up in that entire rigmarole of success and failure and being at the mercy of external forces towards like 2019 in stand-up, where, you know, you go for a show and you do really well and someone's like, yeah, but it's only for 40 people. You know, this guy's doing it for 2,000 in this theater in Delhi. So when you are not kind of looking at this from within and only seeking external forces for validation and approval and success and appreciation, that's when you're in trouble. When you're kind of saying, I'm doing this because I enjoy it, I feel it's a good form, medium for me to express myself. I think I'm doing a good job, getting better as I do more. And you look at the strengths you have, as opposed to you're doing it because you're trying to fill a void and insecurity that you have. Like, oh, you know, say for example, like I can't see. And I'm saying, oh, because, you know, I can't see, but to feel good, I have to make movies because sighted people make movies. I'm obviously working from a place of scarcity, you know? But if I'm a guy who genuinely likes making movies, or I'm a guy who's blind but loves photography for the love of photography, then I'm not going to be too fazed by other photographers. So like that, if you kind of say, okay, these are the things I have and I'm going to use them to kind of experience life. And if you're an artist, then you experience life by creating art in some way. I think that helps. Automatically, you're coming from a place of, you know, the grounding's a little more solid. And I think having a set of people who are, you know, their love for you, their trust in you, their faith in you, their friendship is unshakable based on whether you achieve or not. That's so important, right? Because they, your self-worth is not, let me put it this way, who you are is for them irrespective of what you do.
Yes, beautifully put. Thank you.
It took time, but I'm so glad that I have those people in my life, you know, because otherwise I remember going for parties and people are like, oh my God, here comes Soapy, the comedian. And if I didn't crack jokes, they're like, dude, what happened, man? You lost your sense of humor. I'm like, man, can I be Sandeep the guy or Soapy the guy who just ends up having a good time as opposed to being the funny guy? Mm-hmm. And then I realized I wanted that. So I created this in their eyes and then I let them down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's all self-doing.
Thanks. And plus 1,000 for having good friends. I mean, I underline that a lot. It's important to have good friends. Yeah.
Yeah. And you need support, you know, and I think the biggest support comes from first, as I said, looking at yourself from within and starting the journey there. Because if you're doing things because other people tell you, sure, you're doing things because you think that other people will respect you for that, then you're automatically starting off on a shaky foundation. Well, anyway, I want to talk about a thing. I think we've already gone over time. We're not. Yes. I don't think it's over time. I don't think there was any time to start with. But if you're getting late, no. Documentary theater, what is that?
Documentary theater. Thank you. I'm trying to write a book on what documentary theater is so that the people who ask me this question will have read a bit more. Hopefully the book will be out in 2024, end of this year.
Oh, lovely.
So documentary theater is a form that I stumbled on precisely for all the questions we discussed leading up to this podcast. I wanted to tell my own story. I wanted to make less perfect but freer theater. So as the name suggests, the documentary is to do with a document, and it can be a paper document, it can be an image, a memory, a metaphor. It started with the story of myself that I wanted to tell, and it is also process-based. So I like to put stuff that is not finished, so not a finished, completed product on stage. I often invite the audience to look at my process, and that's sort of my feminist form, which is unfinished, sort of cooking in public, if you will, of my artistic process. That's one way of looking at documentary theater. The other way of looking at documentary theater is a counter-narrative. A counter-narrative to mainstream grand state narratives that we are being fed all the time by mainstream media or in textbooks. So to work with little histories. So I work with people's smaller stories, personal stories that could very gently challenge a predominant narrative. And lastly, for me, the way I'm looking at my documentary theater practice is that it's a whisper, which means, like I said earlier, I don't want to shout. I want to talk softly and I want people to come closer, because you really have to stop talking, go closer to someone, trust them and listen to their stories. In very short, that's what documentary theater is. But like I said, there's a whole book, so it's far more complicated. But just between, like for this audience, it's to do with personal stories and biographies.
No, it's beautiful. I think the thing for me is, I don't use big words because I feel sometimes you're expected to as an artist, right? Like nuance, and people are like, wow, he said nuance. He must be really a good artist.
I like that word too much. I know it's not to self. I try not to use that word. Yeah,
I love it too, but it's just sometimes, you know.
Overuse, yes, yeah. I know. It happens
but
to me.
Having said that, subtlety, I think is very, very nice in art, you know. The gentle touches and the grace. And I think it's so cool to have someone doing this because, again, you know, the moment you do a play, people are like, when are you going to do it at, you know, the NCPA, or when are you going to do it at the 1,000-seater, or when you're taking, you know, when you're taking it to Broadway, which again, I think is hilarious because someone's like, I took my show to Broadway. Then I realized after going to New York, Broadway goes from Manhattan all the way to Albany. It's a damn long road. So where in Broadway did you perform?
Well said. Yes, well said. And also, I mean, also documentary theater, I forgot to mention, it's not a single playwright writing a story. It's many people. It is a series of collaborating eyes that make a story. And that's another thing I enjoy about it, that it's not one authorial voice, again, telling us what the play, it's not Shakespeare. It's not one, one male director or one male writer. It's many voices. That's another thing I enjoy. And I don't think I'm ever going to Broadway because I don't make shiny products. I call you to see the seams of my sleeves. I call you to see the stitching.
Right. And that's, again, I feel a movement which is happening to this, when everyone's shouting, as you pointed out just now, mm-hmm. and it's the glimmery, glittery stuff that is being picked up and, you know, kind of fought over, mm-hmm. whether because it agrees or disagrees or offends or doesn't offend. and, you know, you have the guys doing the Madison Square Gardens and people doing the ultra massive arena tours. I think there's also, I noticed this thing to this, I wouldn't say reverting, which is, sense is a negative thing, but I think there's this shift towards against the smaller rooms, you know?
Yeah.
Someone talked about the 2,000 fans or the 1,000 true fans, as opposed to getting a million views. It's get those 1,000 people on your team who support you for the work you do as an artist, as you grow, as you evolve, as you make your mistakes. They are in it with you because it's you, as opposed to the million who love your special today, but the 2 million who hate you because you changed your style, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something which you mentioned, the whispers. It's getting smaller, getting more intimate, as opposed to just the typical arc of, oh, I started at an open mic for 5 people. Now look where I am. I'm selling out 1,000 tickets in an hour, which, you know, again, there are, you know, benefits to that. But I think with everyone having a chance and everyone, just because they can, they should. I think this is important, you know, to recognize in an artist that, you know, there are ways to find fulfillment and also be heard if you do it at these scales. And I think that's really awesome. You're doing that.
Thank you, Sandeep. Thank you. And you're doing that as well. More power to you. But
yeah.
Standing up and saying no.
Yeah. Whispering on a podcast. Yeah. The 3 people who already can hear me, they're like, what is he saying? Can you increase the volume? But Anuja, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks for taking the time. So where can people catch these pieces of art and the work you're putting out? Where can they catch it? If they're in Bangalore or in other parts of the country or on Broadway.
In 20 years on Broadway. No, my next show will be at the Satyajit Ray Film Institute in Calcutta. So I'm coming to Calcutta with a show called Lady Anandi Redux, which is sort of my opening show that set me on this journey. And it's part of a conference that they're doing on film restoration, run also in collaboration with the Film Heritage Foundation from Bombay. So Satyajit Ray Film Institute in Calcutta on 19th of March. And then I perform in Bangalore. At the Museum of Art and Photography.
I was going to ask you about that MAPS, right? I was going to ask you what your thoughts on that space are.
We need a whole podcast for that. But I like the people that work at MAP currently, the young curators, the programmers. It's a beautiful new space, of course. And they've been patronizing my work now. This is the second year in a row. And I pretty much go and say what I want to. I can be critical of them as well, which is very exciting. So the show there is on 13th of April and it's called I Promise the Bearer.
And it is about, okay.
Yeah, and it is about making money. I make money on stage. I make fictional currency to say that the greatest act of fiction ever created was money, for which we fight wars, kill people. So I Promise the Bearer is in MAP on 13th of March. 13th of April.
Right.
Oh, yeah, 19th
Exciting.
Of March. Satyajit Ray Film Institute, yeah.
That's a very cool concept. I mean, it is a story we've all bought into, which is, yeah, I'd love to maybe come watch that. And maybe please, after that, put up my sketch, which was...
Please come maybe, watch it.
Maybe air guitar to Bohemian Rhapsody with a wig on.
let's do that. And that's a show you'll go back with money. I'll give you the money that I made. It won't buy you much, but you'll still go back with something in your hand.
Hey, it's, you know, sometimes when we dream of school and how we might have missed an exam and we wake up with cold sweats. Something happens. Some of this sketch show, I wake up sometimes because it's like, oh my God, what did I do?
Then you must do it again.
Yeah. We'll collaborate on this and I will get an expert to help me with the due process. But it's been a pleasure. I look forward to catching your plays. That's on the 13th of March in Calcutta and the 13th of March in Calcutta and the 19th of April in Bangalore.
Yes.
Am I right? Okay. We put the links, of course, in the description. And I hope to have you back on the podcast when your book is out to talk more about the process of documentary theater. Anuja, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Likewise. Thank you for reaching out and good luck. You're doing such amazing work, Sandeep.
Glad to hear that and appreciate the kind words. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you like what you heard, please do check out the other episodes on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast. And I would much appreciate it if you could like the video, share it with people who you think might enjoy it. And of course, do subscribe to the channel because it will help me and the podcast grow and reach more people just like you. So thanks again. Appreciate it.